As many of you know, we've recently lost two long-term members of our congregation, Floyd Birkin and George Baxter. Years ago, George Baxter was a minister here, and he was the one to hire Barb Much out of Briarcrest. And since that time, Barbara was the children's pastor here for years, and since that time went on to teach at Carey Seminary, the Baptist Seminary in Vancouver. She has won an award for her preaching. I didn't know that people still win awards.
No, you didn't win an award.
No, you just got to speak at that.
I didn't win an award.
Oh, you
didn't. No awards.
No awards. There's actually a preaching conference, though, and you
one of the speakers. I was invited.
You were invited. One of the guest speakers with a few, very few others.
Yeah.
I was a student at Carey, and she's not going to say anything about... She's probably just forgotten, I'm hoping. But over and over again...
Ask you later. No,
she's forgotten. I have a check for you, and it's not. I'm not going to give it to you if you...
You have to know I did not come for the money.
I do. But one of the things that all of the students would say was that the classes at Carey were excellent, but Barbara Much's classes would change your life. That was my experience. And I think it was 7 years ago I took a class, and I was asked to begin a Lectio Divina with a group of friends. Every Tuesday night, we have never stopped meeting since that time, and it's had a profound impact on our lives and our ministry. When we heard that Barb would be here for the funerals, I asked if she would speak, because God blesses her words. And I know beyond that how many of you still hold her in your hearts. So I'm so grateful, Barbara, that you've made the time to be with us.
Thank you. That's very kind. It's a joy to be with you. I walked through that door and just started smiling. And pretty much everything important to me in the life of my family and in my vocation happened here. In those 15 years when I was on the way to becoming some kind of a grown-up, they happened here in your midst. And so I am really delighted to be with you this morning. And very grateful to Joel, who was a very fine student, for the generous invitation to be with you this morning and worship in this way. So thank you, Joel. Four little words have been deeply formative in my life. Shimmering in one of the earliest sermons that I remember, they have shaped my expectations of God and have borne for me a strange and pretty much unreasonable hope. These four little words, which I can only hear in my head in the King James Version, have companioned me through all that life has brought for the more than 40 years since I heard them first. The words were read in the text by Chris, who I remember as a very small boy. Thank you for that marvelous reading. The words are, some were sawn asunder, or as they appear in the New Revised Version, they were sawn in two. What of hope can such words possibly offer? How can these be gospel words? Well, the words belong, of course, in the letter to the Hebrews, this epistle where mystery waits at every turn. We don't know who wrote Hebrews, nor when it was authored, nor even to whom it was intended. We do know that it was elegantly written, that it is thoroughly informed by the Hebrew Scriptures, and that it is deeply in love with Jesus. And we do know, by paying careful attention, that the Jesus followers to whom it was written, maybe like some of us, are tired. Their hands droop, their joints are weak, they're tired of worship, they're even tired of each other. And they're tired of trying to keep their prayer life going. And to them in their weariness and discouragement, and to us this morning, the preacher offers precisely what we most need, Jesus. A Jesus who is better than Moses, better than angels, better than any religious system. And so the book opens and rolls out for 10 chapters the beauty of Jesus. And then when we get to chapter 11, this: now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. And because that definition of faith is abstract and hard to grab a hold of, the preacher tells us stories. He shows us what faith looks like when it's worn by humans. Rowan Williams says that some people are so knocked sideways by God that they make space for the divine life to come through, and then they stay where God has met them, with God's action and life powering through their own confused hearts and minds and bodies, letting the faith of the earth be renewed. He says that these are the ones who are saints, those who constantly and courageously stand in a place where the light comes through. And that's what we're given here in Hebrews chapter 11. By faith, Abel offered a more acceptable sacrifice. And by faith, Enoch was taken. By faith, Noah respected the warning. By faith, Abraham obeyed. By faith, Isaac. By faith, Jacob. By faith, Joseph. By faith, Moses. The preacher fleshes out this definition with human stories, with stories that contrast what faith looks like with what it does not. And then when we arrive at our text, at verse 29 in chapter 11, the pace begins to quicken. And soon names are mentioned without the commentary. We're supposed to know the stories. Four judges, one king, a priest, a collection of prophets, all with their larger-than-life exploits. Deeds of governance, divine rescue, military victory. Success and triumph abound on every hand. And we have been listening. We know that all of this is because of faith. This is what faith does, we think. It overcomes, it triumphs, it leaps tall buildings in a single bound. Depending on your personality, the list is either inspiring or exhausting. And maybe it's a little of both. We're amazed, we're moved, we're in awe, until verse 35. Contained in the same verse as supernatural return from death to life, these words: others were tortured. And the notion of faith as triumph comes screeching to a halt, but the preacher won't be stopped. The words keep tumbling out, mocking and flogging, chains and imprisonment, poverty and homelessness, torment and persecution, stonings and stabbings, and some were sawn asunder. How are we to understand this? How does being sawn in half belong in the same hall of faith as striding victoriously through the Red Sea? In what way can these be gospel words? Three spacious questions that I think are good ones to bring to any text might help us open up this difficult and somewhat confusing text. They are: what is God doing in the text? What does this tell us about who God is? And then what does it suggest about how we then may relate to such a God? So let's try those with this text. What is God doing here? Well, in the first 11 verses of this text, here's what we see. God is protecting, and God is not protecting. And the examples differ greatly. At first, God is obviously active. At the Red Sea and at Jericho, miraculous and mighty in the lion's den and in battle, God is protecting God's people. Faith is rewarded with victory, and the intervention of God is clearly connected to faith. But here's this thing that this letter, with all of its mystery, does. It insists that the non-intervention of God is also connected with faith. Faith, it seems, is strangely ambiguous. It might lead to triumph and victory, wonders and mighty deeds, and deliverance and healing. But it might just as well lead to some were sawn asunder. It turns out that faith does not look like only one thing. Faith looks like answered petitions and healing from disease, yes. Faith also looks like courage lived out in undelivered suffering, deep sorrow, and death. Faith is not a pass from the natural order of things. It's not a get-out-of-jail-free card. It's not an exemption from disease or divorce or disaster. We do not live in a world where prosperity, good health, and uncomplicated family life come automatically to those who follow God. There has never been such a world. This text offers two pictures of the life of faith. One image is filled with triumph and victory over enemies, and in the other, some are sawn asunder. And many would separate these two pictures into categories of success and failure, yet both are descriptions of trust in God. Direct correlations between faithfully following Jesus and the comfort of our lives simply cannot be drawn. Hebrews simply calls both experiences faith. And those to whom the preacher was writing walked closely with hardship. And if the preacher had offered only pictures of a faith that suffers, that would discourage terribly. But to suggest only that faith equals success would have produced self-doubt and great confusion. So both pictures of faith are presented because both are true. We see here a God who is protecting and not protecting God's people. But we see also in the text, God is dying and ascending. The passage leads us from these twinned images of success and suffering directly into the picture of Jesus in verse 2 of chapter 12, enduring the cross, disregarding the shame, and taking up his seat at the right hand of the throne of God. And in this case, Jesus' suffering and death are presented as his entering into solidarity with all persons, and therefore being able to identify with us in our weariness, in our brokenness, and in our pain, because this is what God does. So, second spacious question, what does this say about who God is? So, one, God has the power to overturn the natural order of things, to pile up oceans, to level walls, to turn aside the appetite of predators. God has the power to heal and to save, to provide and to protect. We sing the mighty power of God that made the mountains rise. And God has the power to work within the natural order of things, to keep planets in orbit, to give skill to surgeons, to nurture growth in the lives of people. Our God is so big, so strong, and so mighty, there's nothing our God cannot do. Here's the other thing that this passage shows us of the ways of God. God does not always intervene. And this single issue may cause us more confusion than any other thing I know. While God can intervene in power and mercy, God does not always do so. Some are sawn asunder. And though not an explanation, words of James Finley that I heard third hand some years ago have settled into me in a deep place over the last decade or so. This love protects us from nothing, sustains us in everything. I've always imagined it as love with a capital L. This love protects us from nothing, sustains us in everything. These are some of the very truest words that I know. And isn't this what we discover when we stand where the light shines in? I believe these words would have resonated with Chris Vine, who for many years was a Presbyterian pastor in southern Ontario. And in an interview with Steve Bell on an old audio magazine I heard years ago, Chris talked about his experience with ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. And Chris said, in response to Moses' encounter with God in the burning bush, when Moses asks God, "Who are you? What's your name?" Moses receives only this cryptic response, "I am who I am, that's who I am." And Chris said that Martin Buber, the Jewish theologian, believed that we have translated these words wrong all these years. That instead of "I am who I am," it should be, "The name of our God is, I shall be there." And so, from the moment we are born and dedicated to God, the name of our God is, "I shall be there." And Chris would ask his Presbyterian Canadian congregation to repeat these words as a litany. Let's try it. "The name of our God is, I shall be there." And he continued in this audio interview, he would say to his congregation every Sunday, first of all standing tall and strong with a clear, strong voice, and eventually with a weaker voice, and eventually from a wheelchair, until he couldn't anymore. He would say, "The ministry and mission of this church is to reach out in the name of Christ and to heal those who are hurt and touch those who are broken and who are in need. And the name of our God is, I shall be there. And whether we go through heartbreak or heartache, sadness or sorrow, the name of our God is, I shall be there. And whether we are touched by disease or hardship, brokenness or frustration, the name of our God is, I shall be there. And when we are laid out in the grave and the last breath goes out of our body, the name of our God is, I shall be there. And then, on that resurrection morning, when trumpets blare and a million suns blaze in the sky, the name of our God is, I shall be there." This is the gospel. God does not always intervene. Faith does not look only one way. Some are sawn asunder. But in every experience, God is there, loving us into wholeness, walking with us into hope. We are not always protected. We are always sustained. So how then might we relate to such a God? Well, this is where faith comes in. Faith can be fully encountered only in terms of the larger story of promise that stretches way, way back. And so Sunday after Sunday, you come and place yourselves in the story as you gather together in this place that holds so many memories. You read the story. You hear the story told. You eat the story in the Lord's Supper. And you go out into the world to live the story with as much courage and grace and goodwill as you possibly can. And then you do it again and again and again. For faith, in many instances, is simply faithfulness, resilience, perseverance. Joan Chittister says that faith is not about understanding the ways of God, but about reverencing precisely what we do not understand. And that faith is one long alleluia sung into a dark night, the only end of which is another challenging dawn. And what makes it possible for faith to endure has everything to do with the life we share with the community of saints, all those who precede us, who surround us, and who will follow us. Because faith cannot be faith if it is severed from the cloud of witnesses. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily besets us, and let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us. And at this point, Rahab and Moses and Abraham and all those listed individually fade into the crowd which becomes just a long chain or a great congregation of faithful people holding on to Jesus and holding on to each other. And that's what this church taught me, that to be human calls us toward participation in a community of fellow creatures, both those who are close to us today and those who are physically absent by dint of time, but present by dint of memory and anticipation, like George and Floyd and all those who have worshipped in these pews before and sang in this choir and taught our children and held our babies and sat and played and laughed with the youth on Friday night. That faith is expressed as faithfulness and draws its strength from those who call us into life, who stand in the place where the light shines through. And faith, as Joel said in the children's blessing, also looks to Jesus, concentrates on the person of Jesus, who is no stranger to suffering, but who, for the sake of the joy that was before him, endured. Faith is not a grit-your-teeth endurance, but a willingness to be vulnerable, to be open to life, willing to be met with joy even in the midst of suffering. We are invited to persevere in the sight of the Savior and in the company of saints, to stay faithful to God, who in Jesus is faithful to us. So I've been thinking it might be time to exchange my four little words for a new one. Not because those words are not true. Faith does not give us a bye from suffering. God does not always intervene. This love protects us from nothing. But it does sustain us in everything. And I'm thinking that those four little words are simply not large enough for all that is true of love and hope and joy and faith. I think the new word that I've landed on is truer because of Jesus and the joy that enabled him to endure, and because of the great cloud of witnesses that call us back to life, whose prayers help us more than we could ever imagine or know. My new word comes from an image that is embedded directly in this text, the cloud of witnesses in the great race of faith. Picture with me the Tour de France, the cycling race, tarnished over the years, yet still offering something of truth. 3 weeks, 2,000 miles, Alps and Pyrenees both. And along every road, through every city, town, and village, and many isolated stretches, people line the roads. Men and women, boys and girls, people deep all along that amazing race. They are clapping, they are cheering, they are ringing cowbells, and they are calling out encouragement. And I have been told that of all the words of encouragement they call out, that there is one single word that is called out more frequently than any other. That is that word that is the greatest and largest word to bring encouragement to those who are struggling to do the race. And that word is courage, or courage. Courage for when the way is hard. Courage for when the climb is steep. Courage for when your muscles are screaming and you don't think you can take another step, and everything in you wants to quit. Courage. Courage in suffering. Courage in intervention. Courage in not intervention, because the name of our God is, I shall be there. May it be so. Amen.